My name is Whitney Schneidman, and I'm a non-resident fellow at the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings, and would just like to welcome you all to our discussion today on China's investment experience in Africa and what it means for the region and U.S. business. I think we're just going to get going. I think people are trickling in, and I think we've got a great panel discussion today. So we don't want to spare any time. But just let me mention, the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings is about 5 years old. It's a partnership, really, with six think tanks on the African continent. And it's really designed to bring to the Washington policy dialogue the African perspective on so many issues: politics, economics, development, human rights, China. And in that sense, it's quite unique. We are also here in partnership with the Congressional African Staff Association and are most appreciative to them for organizing this great facility. AGI has been doing this dialogue on the Hill now for about 2 years, and we really value this opportunity to bring our scholars and research to you and to engage in a dialogue. So today we're very fortunate to have a panel of Yun Sun, who's a fellow in the East Asia Project at the Harry Stimson Center and a former visiting fellow the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings. And just let me commend you her paper, Africa and China's Foreign Policy. It's really one of the most interesting, provocative, and candid analyses on China and Africa that I have read. Sitting next to Yun Sun is David Dollar, who's a senior fellow at the John L. Thornton Center, the Brookings Institution, and a former economic and financial emissary to China at the U.S. Treasury. And to his left is Amadou Sy, who's a senior fellow at the Africa Growth Initiative at Brookings and formerly with the IMF. So our format is that each of the speakers will give some remarks for about 5 minutes. I'll make some concluding comments, and then we'll just jump into a dialogue and maybe end up at we'll go 5 or 10 minutes over if you've got the time and there's interest. But, you know, so let me turn it over to you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Winnie. It's my great pleasure to be here, and I thank Brookings for giving me the opportunity to produce this this report. I hope you find it interesting, and I look forward to an interesting, provocative discussion with you as well. I'm going to talk more about China's challenges, or the challenges, the problems China has encountered in Africa. In recent years, more and more attention has been focused on China's economic engagements and the success story, so-called, in Africa. Compared with the United States, we admire China's ability to treat Africa as a priority, to allocate it all resources necessary to attain its political and economic agendas, and also to have exemplified a high level of moral flexibility in the process. So today, I'll focus on the other side of China's success story in Africa, the challenges and the problems in its operation. So first of all, as China's economic activities and personnel presence expand rapidly on the continent, the security risks and the threats have also grown exponentially. Chinese government's official data suggests that China's cumulative FDI by the beginning of 2013 in Africa is around $22 billion, although Chinese officials in private have acknowledged that the real volume of China's FDI in Africa could easily double or triple that figure. And in terms of personnel, according to incomplete data, there are at least 1 million Chinese nationals currently living in Africa as of the beginning of 2013, because many of these projects and people are based in unstable or politically volatile countries, how to protect their physical security has become a top challenge for Beijing. Several types of security threats toward the Chinese locally on the ground. The most common type is criminal attacks, such as robbery and kidnapping. The ones that have attract much attention globally are the political motivated attacks on the Chinese as a retaliation for China's cooperation with local governments and or for the exploitation of African natural resources. More recently, what we have seen, the more controversial type of attacks have been the attacks on Chinese projects due to labor disputes and illegal activities by the Chinese on the ground. Some examples include the unrest in the coal mine in Zambia against Chinese management and the raid of Chinese illegal gold miners by the Ghanaian government in the past 2 years. Then last but not least, there are attacks on Chinese vessels by the Somali pirates, and the Chinese PLA Navy has dispatched 16 missions and escorted more than 5,000 ships. At the state level, domestic political turmoil and regime change in South African countries have created the most serious challenge to the safety of Chinese investments and nationals. The protection of Chinese nationals in Africa is linked to Beijing's legitimacy, in that a failure to provide such protection would undermine Chinese Communist Party's internal and international prestige. The Chinese government have learned the lesson in the hard way during the civil war in Libya in 2011, when China was forced, partially by domestic public opinion, to mobilize significant military and diplomatic resources to evacuate more than 30,000 Chinese nationals based in Libya. And Chinese PLA also dispatched military aircrafts and one naval vessel for the mission. Nonetheless, the regime change in Libya resulted in a total loss as high as $20 billion for Chinese companies on the ground due to the uncompleted contracts originally made with the Gaddafi government. So Beijing essentially lacks the capacity to protect Chinese nationals and investment in Africa. Consular protection is weak, as every Chinese consular officer at the Chinese embassy in Africa has to serve 130,000 overseas Chinese nationals in average. Military protection by the Chinese PLA is out of the question because China strictly follows the principle of no overseas military deployment unless there is a UN mandate and also host country consent. Private security firms are a popular speculation. It is said that the ex-CEO of Blackwater, Eric Prince, is now working enthusiastically with large Chinese state-owned enterprises in Africa. But Beijing will need to address related legal and political barriers before making any substantial commitment. China's economic activities in Africa have also become a rising reputational risk for Beijing as well. International scrutiny and criticisms have focused on Chinese investment in less developed authoritarian or semi-authoritarian African countries. Some common criticisms include that China's economic activities are only about natural resources exploitation, China props up authoritarian regimes, or Chinese investments undermine efforts to strengthen democracy and human rights, and at the same time contribute to corruption, environmental and social degradation. Chinese analysts and some American scholars have come up with some very powerful rebuttals, such as despite the downside, China still provides infrastructure projects to African countries and creates revenue. And they also pointed out that Western companies have demonstrated similar behavior patterns in Africa. Nevertheless, the public humiliation and the damage to China's international image and prestige have been particularly disturbing for Beijing. They also undermine the viability and success of Chinese projects on the ground. These security challenges and reputational costs to China raised a more fundamental question about China's engagement in Africa within the Chinese foreign policy community. And the question is, does China really have an Africa strategy? In the view of most Africa specialists in China, China has different goals in Africa, but does not have a long-term strategy. China has two clear defined goals. One is political. China wants the political support and friendship of African countries. And the other one is economic, which means China wants profitable commercial ties, which results in business entities' mercantilistic profit-seeking behaviors in Africa. So unfortunately, Beijing does not have an effective coordination system so far to manage the conflicts between the two. And in many cases, the Ministry of Commerce and Chinese companies have operated in a way beyond the knowledge and the reach of Chinese embassies on the ground. And the foreign policy folks, for example, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, believe that China's broader strategic goals is being inevitably undermined by China's economic endeavors in Africa. But so far, the foreign policy folks do not really have the ways and means to address the issue from within. So this is the most direct and serious internal dispute and bureaucratic infighting within the Chinese system on China's engagement in Africa. I'll stop there and look forward to the discussion.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you. David?
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'm in the China Center at Brookings, and I've started a line of research on China's direct investment in Africa. Think of this as kind of following on to the work that Yun Sun has done, which is published today. So my work is at an early stage, and want to share some ideas and some early results with you, but particularly interested in hearing what people are thinking about, what they're interested in. So I want to introduce 3 points into the conversation. You know, the first concerns the volume of Chinese direct investment in Africa. You know, this has been growing very, very rapidly and has gotten a lot of attention, and there's certainly been a couple of big deals, but I want to start by putting this in perspective. As Yun Sun said, the stock of Chinese foreign investment in Africa, according to the Ministry of Commerce, is a little bit above $20 billion. That would be about 4% of China's total outward investment. And as Yun Sun said, there are reasons to think it might be underestimated a little bit, so you might raise that a little bit. But you know, the first point I want to make is that Africa is not the centerpiece of China's overseas investment. China's overseas investment is primarily in neighboring countries in Asia. Nevertheless, if you get to a number around, you know, 6 or 7%, maybe 8% of Chinese foreign investment in Africa, that's actually reflecting a lot more interest in Africa than the rest of the world evidences. If you look at total foreign direct investment in the world, only 3% of it is in Africa. If you look at the United States foreign investment, the United States is the largest provider of foreign investment, only 1% of U.S. foreign investment is in Africa. So, relatively speaking, China is showing more interest in Africa, investing more in Africa. But having said that, China is still a small player. You know, the U.S. may only put 1% of its foreign investment in Africa, but the U.S. is overwhelmingly the largest provider of foreign direct investment in the world. So that amounts to a much larger stock of foreign investment than China has provided. So, you know, U.S. direct investment, the stock in Africa is 2 to 3 times higher than the stock of Chinese investment. So I'm just starting by putting that in perspective. I think that's interesting that, you know, relatively speaking, China seems more involved or invested in Africa. But I was a little bit surprised when I first looked at these numbers that, in fact, you know, the U.S. is a much larger investor in Africa than China is. So the data do not support the idea that China is, you know, taking over Africa. Now, the second point I want to make is that, you know, it is correct that some of that Chinese investment is directed at natural resource extraction. You know, so if you take different measures of natural resource wealth or natural resource rents as a share of GDP, you know, China's investment in Africa is very clearly correlated with natural resource wealth of the recipient countries. But the same thing is true for the United States investment, and the same thing is true for foreign investment in general in Africa. And in fact, I can't see any evidence that China is more attracted to natural resources than, say, United States investors or global investors. So it is a fact that Africa is relatively rich in natural resources. A lot of foreign investment is oriented at resource extraction. That's true for China, but it seems to be equally true for U.S. investment and for global investment. I'm impressed that China seems to have direct investment in pretty much every African country. Some African countries, of course, are not resource wealthy, so it's interesting that China is pretty much everywhere. A recent study found that 22% of the Chinese foreign investment in Africa is in the manufacturing sector, So while natural resources are important, there's also a significant amount of Chinese investment in manufacturing. And there's growing trend toward the Chinese investment coming from private investors, and there are lots of small private Chinese investors working in Africa, often in service sectors, but some of those in the manufacturing sector. So I think that's an interesting development. When I've discussed this line of research with some African officials, one of the reactions that I got was that one of the reactions I got was, you Westerners think of Africa as a continent that needs aid and help, and the Chinese come to Africa and see an investment opportunity. And frankly, it's flattering to be seen as an investment opportunity, not just as a charity case. So I think that that's backed up by the data I've seen so far, that you do have quite a bit of Chinese investment in manufacturing and services. I would predict that that trend strengthens, because while some of China's initial outward movement was aimed at natural resource extraction, one thing that's happened is that China's economy is becoming less dependent on natural resources. China is undergoing a domestic rebalancing in which investment is slowing down quite significantly, and the consumption is rising, the service sectors are rising. So some of the anticipated need for natural resources in China is not panning out. China's demand for copper and other metals I don't think I would say it's declining. I would say that it's on a lower trend than many people had thought. So you've noticed the recent softening in copper prices and other commodity prices. I think that's a real permanent trend that China's rebalancing. And as it does so, it's going to be looking for different things in its outward investment, more likely to be investing in manufacturing and services. So continues to be involved in Africa, and I'm right about that trend. That's potentially a very positive and healthy development. Now, the third point I want to make is, there is something of a caricature of China, going into some very poor governance environments in Africa. So I do want to look into that. As I said, China is pretty much everywhere, so they're in the good governance environments as well as poor ones. But it is true that the Chinese stock of foreign investment is clearly correlated with poor governance, as measured by various rule of law indices or democracy measures. So there is a tendency for China's share of investment to be especially large in countries that have poor governance. Some examples are DR Congo, Central African Republic, Guinea-Bissau, Zimbabwe. It's not so much that it may actually be the case that, as I said, Chinese investment seems to be everywhere. Western investment is definitely staying away from the poor governance environments, and so it may just be that the Chinese share is relatively higher because Western foreign investment tends to stay away from the poor governance environments. So I think that's an interesting area I want to explore further. It's possible that the Chinese assess risks differently, that Chinese state enterprises are not worried about poor rule of law, but as Yun Sun said, there's growing concern about security of Chinese people, for example. So it's also possible that this is a learning process, and the Chinese investors are learning that there's a good reason why investment stays away from poor governance environment. It's hard to run an economic operation and make a profit. My hypothesis is that a lot of the Chinese investment in the poor governance environments is not working out well. The Heritage Foundation keeps a list of troubled Chinese projects, and I haven't examined this too carefully yet, but my casual inspection suggests that there are a lot of troubled investments in the poor governance environments, which is what I would expect. But at least it's a hypothesis to explore. So let me end my... I may have gone a little bit over my 5 minutes, but let me end by saying that I think a good hypothesis to explore is that Chinese investment is evolving, and in many ways it's becoming more like Western foreign investment. It has some focus on natural resource wealth, but it's actually diversifying into services and manufacturing. And I wouldn't be surprised if you saw some reevaluation of the investments in the poor governance environments, because I think a lot of those investments are not going to work out well. But it's an interesting thing to study, whichever way that goes. Thank you very much.
Great. Amadou.
Yeah, thank you. Again, thanks for having me here. I will try to bring a bit the quote-unquote African perspective, knowing that we have 44 countries or more. So the first thing is that China is not a newcomer in Africa. I mean, I remember from my childhood seeing Chinese engineers building our biggest stadium, right? So they had this checkbook diplomacy, you know, stadiums, theater, big buildings, and then countries would run and recognize Taiwan and get another check, and then 5 years later, go back to Beijing and get another check. So that was China is not a newcomer. I think what is new is the emphasis on trade and investment rather than aid. So in terms of stock, OECD countries, in terms of stock of FDI, OECD countries are the largest in Africa. But when you look at the flows and you look at the trend, the growth, the recent growth of capital flows in Africa is due to these newcomers. And China is not, it's led by China, but you have the other BRICS. So there's this quote-unquote South-South investment, which is driving a lot of the new growth in capital flows that you in capital flows that you see in Africa. And the other interesting trend is like the data we have looking at capital flows and ODA in sub-Saharan Africa shows, for example, in 2012 you had from the DAC countries, so that doesn't include China, but aid flows were about 43 billion to sub-Saharan Africa, compared with 67 billion of capital flows, right? So in a sense, Africa is getting more and more integrated in the global economy through the BRICS, through China. And that's very that's something very new, that's something very interesting that raises a lot of expectations. This focus on investment and trade is very very interesting and very appealing to many policy African policy leaders, because right now what we hear from policy Africa policy makers in Africa is all about this transformational agenda. So Africa needs infrastructure. Data from the World Bank is about 100 billion needs, infrastructure needs. The fiscal revenues in these countries will not be able to cover it. Savings are low, domestic savings are low. So Africa needs foreign savings, it needs capital. And so it's all about transforming the economy. And we need jobs, we need you know, skills, and China has this model. You know, this growth commission was saying that you need to grow by more than 7% per year, and if you do that, you can double the size of your economy in 10 years. And very few countries have done it. I think only Botswana in Africa has done it. Mozambique is close but has its own issues, but Mozambique has had this sustained high growth. So the so-called Chinese model is very interesting to many African policymakers. So now if you compare, we just concluded the EU-Africa summit. What were the big issues there? It was mostly peace and security, mostly about the Central African Republic, the crisis in the Central African Republic, about securing trade routes off the Horn of Africa or the Gulf of Guinea, about migration. It was about who was invited, not invited, Mugabe's wife, President Bashir's of Sudan's not being invited. So that was the main issue. But, you know, in the back, if you see, Paris, for example, what Dlamini Zuma of the African Union was saying, it was all about the need for skilling up our people, the need of not making the same mistakes as we did for mining, and this time letting the processing happen in Africa. So this disconnect between one audience, which is still focused on aid, on governance, and the other audience, which is all about how do you transform the economy? How do you grow faster? How do you, make that growth sustainable is something that is there and is less apparent when African countries deal with China. So I've kind of thought about four issues when you take the perspective, this transformational agenda perspective. One is the size of the financing gap. It's huge, and domestic revenues will not be enough to fill that gap. So there, China and other countries also are very interesting. So if I'm a minister and I have all these highways and these power plants that I have to build, I'm interested in China. They can build a coal-generated power plant very quickly, 2-3 years. Last time we had a meeting at Congress with some private investors, they were saying the true comparative advantage of China is speed when it comes to Africa. So we're interested by that. If you look at, for example, how China has started building these solar panels and the cost of this solar panel has gone down. It's something very interesting when you have this huge infrastructure gap and you're thinking of non-renewable energy, for example. The second point is Africa is more integrated globally through China. Let's take the case of Zambia. You can think about Zambia as a big copper mine. All right. So Zambia sells copper mostly, and then copper prices depends heavily on what is on Chinese demand. And it's not only the macro, because last time I was reading this article about the shadow financial system and how copper is used as a collateral to secure loans. So if I were the Zambian policymaker, I would really, really try to study what's happening with Chinese demand, what's happening with Chinese shadow banking system, because it has an impact on the copper price, and how do I have some policies to manage that? Third, Africa could benefit from this domestic rebalancing. If China's increases its reliance on its domestic consumption, and then let's say wages in China start increasing, and then that could prompt China to relocate some industries, right? But there we have the competition of countries like Vietnam. So, but that's something, you've seen Ethiopia that has managed to attract Chinese industry, having shoe factory in Ethiopia. There's something very appealing. And fourth, I think it's not really a matter of either or. It's not Chinese investment in Africa. It's not mutually exclusive with U.S. Investment. First of all, it can bring a healthy competition. And let's take, for example, some sectors. Let's take offshore exploration. But there, the U.S. has a competitive advantage. Chinese firms are not yet there. It takes Texas, and people in Texas are very good at that. They're very good at this offshore, exploring, offshore exploration, and the technology and the know-how is not there yet in China. But when it comes to renewable energy, solar panels, China is very competitive. So I think it can, let's take telecom, right? So I don't like this image, but people say that, this cheap Nokia phone is the AK-47 of telephones, right? It's very durable, and all over Africa, you go to a village, people have that Nokia phone, and it's changing people's life, right? Lives. But now, if you go to the cities, people are more and more interested by smartphones. So Huawei might bring cheaper smartphones, and Africa is a big market ready for that. And then that can help at least those in the cities have access to the internet, right? So that's something that is very interesting. But I think the key issue really is African policymakers need to be prepared, not even now, but yesterday, to really benefit from capital flows. Academic literature shows that you need macroeconomic stability, you need good governance, you need good policies, and most importantly, you need speedy and adequate implementation of these policies. So there we have some lessons from Korea or Malaysia on how to implement policies very well. Africa is discovering more and more natural resources, and there are three points, revenue generation, you know, which type of contract do you have? Do you have royalties, taxes, and so on? Fiscal rules, you know, how do you make sure, you know, you don't spoil this benefit, and the quality of public investment. Another policy priority is also to find way to attract investment in sectors other than the natural resources, right? It's not easy, and the Chinese are starting to do it. So that's very interesting, too. Infrastructure, I've talked about it. But the issue also, coming back to these sectors, is not to have these enclave economies. You can have a mine sometimes in a country and you would not even know it. And somewhere very far, or let's say it's offshore, you don't see them. Nobody in your city or in your village is working for them. It's really an enclave economy. So how do you get skills, transfer of skills? How do you get, let's say, also agriculture? How do you get in the global value chain of these big firms, right? And I'm sure that as Chinese companies get grower, they will also have this global value chain. Not everything is made; it will be manufactured in China. So these are some issues, I think, that are very important right now. As Africa is having many, many friends, how do you prepare yourself to really benefit from that?
Great, thank you very much, Amadou. Let me just comment and touch on some points, but sort of pick up where on a point that Amadou referred to, and just sort of put the big question out there. Is the U.S. and China, U.S. business, Chinese business, is this, you know, conflict or cooperation somewhere in between? And I raise this because, you know, over the last decade or so, there's been a dialogue between the Beijing consensus and the Washington consensus. I think we're all familiar with the Washington consensus of market-based economies, low inflation, low budget deficit, and the Beijing consensus of a more mercantile approach to trade and where governance and human rights don't figure in. But let me just read a quote from Yun Sun's report that I thought was so interesting and revealing that we don't hear much. And it's this: the more countries identify with and adopt Beijing's approach, the less isolated Beijing feels. Beijing would like to see non-Western, non-democratic governments grow and prosper in Africa, simply because it would help validate China's political system and mitigate its international isolation by showing that Western democracy is not a universal value and that the Western democratic system does not have to apply in every country. Bold comment. But I think a couple things. When you look at what's happening on the African continent, there will be 16 elections this year, South Africa, and next year a similar number of major elections in Nigeria, even Central African Republic wants to have elections. I think it's fair to say that the aspiration for democracy is very real. But I think what this quote suggests is that there's still a bit of an ideological struggle, a struggle over the policy environment on the continent. At the same time, Yun Sun's report quotes a Chinese scholar, He Wenping, who says that in recent years, Beijing has made efforts to provide training and human resources development to African countries. Now, we've worked with He Wenping in the context of our Africa-China-U.S. trilateral dialogue, and that has been an effort to identify common areas of cooperation. And Yun Sun's report refers to peace and security as a potential area of cooperation, and I think that's really the dynamic that we're seeing. We're seeing, as David referred to, China, you know, focusing on some countries where there's poor governance, but we're also seeing areas such as peacekeeping where China is cooperating with the U.S., and China is part of international peacekeeping operations, which suggests that there are other areas that we can focus on to ensure that the cooperation agenda, I think, really becomes paramount over any other agenda, because I think that's really in the interests of Africa and the African economic development agenda. You know, the title of this is like implications for U.S. business, and let me just make one or two comments. Clearly, this is not a zero-sum proposition. When you talk to U.S. companies, let's say in the extractive sectors, I don't think any of the U.S. companies feel that they've been on something that the Chinese got and it was zero-sum at all. In fact, quite the contrary. You see Chinese firms participating in blocks that are operated by American and Western oil companies. But in the infrastructure space, there's no question that there's a lot of competition going on. And I think here again, Western firms, American firms, ask, you know, are the ground rules clear? Are they fair? Are they transparent? And I think increasingly the answer is no, because many Chinese firms, you know, aren't responsible to shareholders. And, you know, the balance sheets aren't available and subsidies are a factor. So in certain respects, there's not a level playing field when it comes to competing in the African market. I was interested in the report by the comment that MOFCOM, the Chinese Commerce Department, is inclined to allocate its aid budget according to where China sees its largest number of commercial opportunities. And that sounds reminiscent of the United States about circa 1975, where, you know, if it was Mobutu Zaire, we were all in with our aid budget. But I think we've learned that correlation doesn't really work. And that's why the Millennium Challenge Corporation is sort of a new approach. They make resources available and say to the government, you go to the international market, you put it to tender, and you decide which company is best for you. And that's unfortunately worked to the disadvantage of some U.S. companies. But I think it has helped to level the playing field, and it's certainly removed this notion that we're playing favorites, because there's a clear set of criteria about what companies or what countries are going to be selected for MCC grants. Another reference to migrants and migration. I recently saw a study by Edward Lin, a scholar at UC Berkeley, who's done a lot of participatory analysis of Chinese coming to Africa. And he makes a really important point that Chinese, to use your number, there's some a million Chinese that are living in Africa. Vast majority are in South Africa. And they come there for the freedom of being their own boss. And they come there for self-employment and to exercise their freedom of mobility. Yes, they recognize there's a trade-off. There's a loss of freedom associated with crime. But I guess I'd end on this note. I think the dialogue that we need to have with China and with Chinese companies as it relates to Africa is precisely the point that what Mamadou said. We need jobs and skills. Africa needs jobs and skills. And that's what we don't see happening with Chinese investment in Africa. China brings its own laborers, sort of stay in their own community. The migrant shopkeepers don't hire and train local Africans to work in the shops. So there's this isolation effect of China in Africa that I personally think is going to work to the disadvantage of China over time, and doesn't help to sort of support the broader development agenda that Africa and many of its partners share. So let me just stop with those remarks and open it to the floor, and we welcome any questions or comments. You shouldn't all raise your hand at once, but please identify yourself.
Hi, I'm Allie McGee. I work for the Whitaker Group, and thank you all for sharing your research and your insights with us today. My question is for Yun Soon. As Whitney said, the playing field largely is not level, especially in the infrastructure space. However, the criticisms that are coming from the West like the Chinese are propping up dictatorships and, you know, pursuing corrupt practices. Those aren't the same set of concerns that are coming from the African side, which are mostly quality control issues and lack of transfer of knowledge and skills. So I'm wondering if the Chinese government and the SOEs that are playing in the infrastructure space, are they starting to change their business strategy to address these concerns? Are they starting to feel the pressure coming from these African governments rather than just Western media? And do you see any trends changing there?
Sure, great question. There have been plenty of complaints made by African governments to Beijing that your investment or infrastructure projects in our country does not bring us everything we want. There's actually an interesting debate in the policy circle in Beijing about that. One school of scholars would say, African countries, you need to prioritize. Which one do you want more? Do you want a speedy completion of your project? If that is your goal, then you better use Chinese workers because we can complete the project in a timely manner. But if you also, at the same time, want training, you want to promote your own your sustainable growth, that is going to take longer. So the Chinese scholars' perspective would rather ask the question to the African governments as for which they prioritize. And as for the Beijing Chinese government's position, they will tailor their supplies or their projects to the need of African governments, especially when the local complaints are high. Beijing takes that very seriously because that damages bilateral ties. But the demand has to be made by the African governments, and it has to be also very clear about what their priority is.
Let me get you to comment on that as well, how, you know, the quality issue and the training issue. And
I think, to me, the whole debate should not be really, I think, about like a blame game. From the perspective I have, it's about African policymakers having, you know, clear policies, clear strategies, and thinking how to implement that, right? So unless that happens, it's very difficult to proceed. It will not benefit the future generations of Africans. So I think that's where it should start, good policies back at home.
Yeah, in the back. Interesting question. But I think Amir has some thoughts on that.
I think the difference is that having been to some U.S. agencies here and so on, is typically, I think, the perception, the way it works in the U.S. is that, and correct me if I'm wrong, is that government would follow companies. It would not just go there and say, hey, you know, we're laying the ground, come in. Which is different from for even like other countries, but I think there's a lot of goodwill towards the U.S. really, frankly, when it comes to Africa. It's perceived as, you know, largest economy. I mean, militarily, the military power is there, and it's not a former colonial power. So I think there's a lot of goodwill. Now, So we were thinking about this U.S.-Africa Leader Summit that will, the first one that will happen with some of our colleagues. I mean, all the other countries have had this for a long time. It's going to be the first time for the U.S. And then we were thinking, well, how will it be different from the EU summit? So we were thinking, we were betting that when it comes to money, to funds, the U.S. will not put a lot of money on the table for African countries. You know, the FOCAC, which is the China-Africa summit, or the Japanese, the TICAD, which is Japan-Africa summit, they always end up with this like $30 billion over this many years. This will not happen here, we bet. But what will happen is Power Africa, and I think this is, Power Africa is a very interesting model, and really think that it can work and hopefully be extended to other countries, because you have all these U.S. agencies kind of being sherpas and trying to bring in the private sector. And so that's not aid, definitely not aid. And I think, and it also addresses this big infrastructure gap that we're talking about. So the priorities are aligned. And I think that's a very interesting model. There's Trade Africa also, and there's AGOA also. So, I mean, I don't think there's this perception really when it comes to Africa. But again, like, let's take AGOA. It's been, and Whitney is more a specialist than me, but it's been here for a long time. But in terms of volume of exports from Africa to the U.S., we haven't seen this huge jump. So, you know, how do we really get Africans to get the, how do Africans themselves get the right policies to benefit from something like AGOA, right? So I was very happy when I saw a McDonald's uniform made out of Kenya.
David, do you want to comment on?
Yeah, I'm afraid I have to disagree a little bit. I do think, well, I'm happy to hear what you said, but I do think the U.S. influence in Africa is waning to some extent, at least relatively. You know, so the U.S. still has a very large stock of foreign investment there, and the stock is important because that tells you, you know, that's capital stock on the ground that's producing value. So the U.S. has a major role. Western foreign investment, Western development assistance, you know, these are all very large. But, you know, China is rising very rapidly as a supplier of different types of finance to Africa. China has obviously caught a lot of people's attention. So my sense is the U.S. influence is, relatively speaking, is waning. There are things the U.S. can do to maintain an important position in Africa. And I think there's certainly room for more diplomatic attention from the United States. The United States easily gets distracted in different parts of the world, and so I think there's room for more diplomatic attention. And then, as you say, you know, thinking about ways that African countries could actually take advantage of access to the U.S. market. You know, sometimes small amounts of technical assistance can actually make a big difference in terms of who actually, you know, accesses the market. So I would certainly welcome more attention from the U.S. government to Africa. But, you know, the U.S., of course, has a lot of issues in the world that has to worry about.
Yeah, can I just add, so actually that's interesting because, did you know that President Obama will be welcoming the president of Djibouti, I mean, which is this small, but it's a military base for the U.S. and France. So it's true. The love is not being reciprocated. It's more about oil, about security, and actually President Bush did a lot, terms of aid and so on. So the FDI stock is still large, but if you look at portfolio flows also, it's, you know, we have this trend where a lot of African countries are starting to issue euro bonds and so on, and most of the money comes from the U.S. and the U.K., well, because where these financial centers are. But there's something which is increasing. So, like, I was at a conference from fund managers and so on, and talking about frontier markets and so on, and a lot of them were ready to allocate a small percentage, but they're so huge compared to Africa, you know. So the thing is, so portfolio flows is increasing, but it's true that, you know, the traditional interests in oil security are still there.
I'll make a few points. I think I agree with David Moore on the issue, because if you compare the diplomatic resources and the level of attention that China devotes to Africa, there's simply no comparison. President Xi Jinping, after his inauguration, his first overseas trip, he visited 5 African countries together with Russia. So I don't think that's, we're going to see that happening to a U.S. president in the years to come. So so in comparison, I do see that China's influence on the continent is rising. But on the other hand, if you talk to the Chinese, they're actually very jealous of the achievements that the U.S. has achieved in terms of its soft influence in Africa. The Chinese find the African countries, African governments, African officials admire U.S. system, admire U.S. standards, and they don't have no admiration for the Chinese Chinese political system or the Chinese way of investment at all. So the Chinese feel that we want to copy the success of U.S. not only through our financial contributions to the continent, but also win the heart of the African people. So that's being pointed out constantly in the Chinese community. Then you hear these interesting comments from some Chinese diplomats saying that the African officials, African governments, actually tell the Chinese government that they don't want U.S. and China to cooperate too closely, because they want to keep a little check and balance between the two, and they can maximize their flexibility and their maneuverability. So there is certainly that sense coming out of the African governments as well. So last but not least, I think in terms of the comparison of Chinese influence and American influence, it also depends on which country you're talking about. Because in the more authoritarian or the semi-authoritarian countries, China's influence is quite absolute, because U.S. is not there. So I'll stop there. Thank you.
Just to respond to this very interesting question, I think we have two things going on here. One is Africa's place on the U.S. foreign policy agenda, and there I think I would agree that we can always do more and we always need to do more. One stark example is that the Secretary of Commerce, Pritzker, is going to Africa next month. She'll be the first fully confirmed Secretary of Commerce to visit Africa since Don Evans in 2002, which is just stunning when you think of it. So I think there's a struggle for attention, there's a struggle for resources. But is the U.S. Losing influence in Africa? I think I would disagree with David and Yun Sun and say, I don't think so. I think there's a tremendous amount of residual goodwill. I think there's shared values in many respects. And I think the most recent, the most stirring example is the Young Africa Leaders Initiative of the Obama administration. They went online, live online in December, to advertise, to accept applications for 500 spaces for 500 Washington fellows to come to the United States. They got 50,000 applications of folks between 25 and 35. These are all self-identified leaders, and I just think speaks volumes and very powerful volumes about, you know, the interest in the U.S. and the connection with our universities, with our companies, with our civil society organizations, and with our government, as unbelievable as that may be sometimes. Still, I think there's a lot to build on there. So, yeah, move back.
Thank you. This Warwick McGill from OIC International. This question is specifically for Sun, but I'd like some comments from the rest of the panel if you like. One place, and one of the panelists mentioned that Africa needs jobs and skills. One of the things that's interesting for me is taking a long view when you look at the youth population in Africa and that large demographic bulge. My question is, if you want this to be a real demographic dividend, then you have to train that labor. Because there is a nexus between no jobs, lack of opportunity, and instability on the security side. And so if you're looking at the long view, the question becomes, how do you take what could be a demographic dividend and invest in it versus allow it to continue to fester and become a challenge for you in terms of stability? And just finally, on the point of Power Africa, you know, we say to China, you bring in these big investments, these big infrastructure projects, and you don't train the labor. One of the holes that I see in the Power Africa project is we're talking about mobilizing capital, while missing the opportunity to really do knowledge transfer and hire a number of people in the country who can maintain these projects after you leave. If anyone lives in Montgomery County, you know that if the wind blows and the lights go out, Pepco needs to get crews out to immediately maintain lines and other sorts of things. So there's a whole host of different things I think we could do on the labor and human resource side with Power Africa to set an example for the Chinese about how you do investments and training and get the objective done on both sides of the aisle. Thank you.
Then you want to make this final comments as well.
Okay. I'll be quick. On the labor and the training, the youth population issue, I would say that goes back to the essential question of China's Africa engagement. Does China have a strategy? And the criticism in China is China does not. China first went to Africa. Well, you see the rising of Chinese FDI in Africa. Started around somewhere between year 2000, 2005, is when China first launched a going out strategy. And initially, China's goal was very clear. It was natural resources. It was to bring the resources back to China to fuel the domestic growth. So after a few years, after the Chinese companies engaged in that field of activities, they realized that Africa also needs infrastructure. And infrastructure projects could be used as a good collateral to achieve more natural resources deals. That's what the Chinese call the resources for development or resources for infrastructure. That's when the Chinese got into the infrastructure field. And then now we are at a point that China has explored both natural resources extraction and the infrastructure development. And China needs to respond to the problems on the ground. So when China realized that both there is a reputational risk, both, and also there is a security risk, and also concerns the long-term sustainable growth of China's presence in Africa, and also the long-term sustainable development of the African countries, China is going to take actions. But to expect China to begin with that is simply not how the Chinese foreign policy model works. China will respond to demand, and respond to problems, and respond to criticisms. That's the best way to get China to take actions on a specific issue. And I do think that Xi Jinping administration is taking some policy initiatives in that direction. Although we need to be a little bit patient, because that could take a few years to happen.
Yeah, I think it's reasonable to, Yun Sun says, it's reasonable to expect African countries to take the lead in this and, you know, in demanding what they want. I encourage African countries to look at the Chinese experience in some of these areas. When China first started welcoming foreign investment after 1978, it was extremely restrictive about any labor coming into China. So you had a lot of arguments between the early foreign investors and the Chinese authorities, where the early foreign investors wanted, you know, they didn't want to bring in a lot of ordinary labor, but they wanted to bring in what I would describe as large amounts of labor, you know, and the Chinese attitude was, no, we want you to train Chinese workers to do the skilled things and be part of management. So they often had very strict quotas on how many foreign visas essentially could be associated with a project. And then, as was suggested by one of the earlier comments, that naturally slows things down, right? I mean, if you're trying to build something quickly, then training people along the way is going to slow things down. So it really is an African choice, but I would say look at the Chinese experience. They got a lot of mileage out of making the foreign investors train people, and obviously now they can. You've got Chinese companies that have spun off from those investments that are now out-competing the international firms that they used to be working for, and that's a really healthy development.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the Voice of America yesterday, you had this title, say, Ghana wants locals to benefit from oil production. So there is this issue of local content regulation. So, again, me, I'm always taking from the point of view of what good policies in Africa should Africa get to benefit from all of this. And so now, this local content regulation, I think the devil is in the detail. You can just have it there for political reasons and so on, and then say, okay, you need to hire people locally that they hire, they're not trained, and so on. But, you know, putting the Minister of Education with the Minister of Mining together, you know, and asking companies, you know, how can you get into the value chain? Maybe you won't train the engineers quickly, but you can train some technician that can do something, or it's the suppliers and so on. I think this is key. Because, as you say, if this youth bulge is not transforming into a dividend, we don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. By the way, talking about companies, I think there are interesting things coming in the tech, TMT, ICT. Like I've seen, like as Microsoft and IBM are having these training centers in Africa, Huawei also is having one. But you see different models. Some are like, okay, you have this open... how do you call it anyway? This open space where people collaborate and do some programming, and I think the Chinese they're training skills for medium. How do you call it anyway? From technician and things like that. So you have different skills, but the demand is definitely there.
I just respond and then on this note we've sort of run out of time, but to say I think personally. Almost the best face of the U.S. in Africa are those companies like GE, Procter & Gamble, Microsoft, Google, IBM, that are really, you know, training local people and going out and hiring local people, not just to be at the bottom or the mid-levels, but to be the top-level managers, too. And I think when you go to work for a U.S. company in Africa, you enter their workforce with the idea that you can rise to the top. And I think it's a very compelling dynamic. I think we can do better. I think we can do more. But I think it's a really powerful dynamic that we've woken up to, that we can contribute to the economic development process. So let me just wrap up right there. Thank you all for taking time for your schedules to come. Let me also thank the Congressional African Staff Association for being our host up here. And on behalf of the African Growth Initiative, just thank you again and wish you a good afternoon. Thank you.